It's 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Syrian opposition groups agree on a framework for possible talks. More than 100 representatives wrapped up a meeting in Riyadh on Thursday with a plan for holding talks with the government of President Bashar al-Assad. The group still needs to pick up its representatives for a negotiating team. In related news, diplomats from the U.S., Russia, and the United Nations plan to meet in Geneva on Friday to discuss ways to advance the peace process in Syria. In spite of differences with the U.S. over the fate of the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, Secretary of State John Kerry says Russia has been constructive in the multinational effort to find a political settlement for Russia, for Syria. Mr. Kerry commented on the sidelines of the climate change summit in Paris. The secretary announced plans to travel to Moscow next week for talks on Syria as well as the unrest in Ukraine. Russia's Interfax news agency said the Kremlin had not ruled out a Putin-Kerry meeting during the upcoming trip. The U.S. military says the coalition fighting Islamic State militants in Iraq and Syria has killed the group's finance minister and two other senior leaders. Spokesman Steve Warren said Thursday the attacks killed Abu Salah, the Islamic State's financial minister, and another leader who acted as an executive officer.
Their removal will degrade ISIL's ability to command and control troops, and it disrupts their ability to finance their efforts.
The deaths came in recent weeks as a result of coalition airstrikes. One of the top fugitive suspects in the 1994 Rwandan genocide has been arrested in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The United Nations says Ladislas Ntaganzwa, a former mayor accused of orchestrating the deaths of some 20,000 ethnic Tutsis, was arrested in Congo on Wednesday. This is VOA News. With a Friday deadline approaching, delegates from 196 countries meeting near Paris are in a race to reach a wide-ranging climate agreement. A Wednesday draft of the agreement release showed differences remain substantial, especially on key questions involving the responsibility of richer nations to fund climate change programs for poorer countries. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is optimistic.
I think we are standing at this time at a very critical moment. I'm hopeful and I'm reasonably optimistic that we will be able to have, for the first time in the history of the United Nations, a universal and very ambitious climate change agreement.
Core areas of dispute also include the demand by developing nations for an agreement and corresponding commitments to prevent global temperatures from rising a maximum of 2 degrees Celsius over pre-industrial levels. Divers are exploring a lake in San Bernardino, California, where the husband and wife who killed 14 people last week were reported to have been seen on the day of the shootings. Assistant FBI Chief for Los Angeles David Bowditch would not discuss what specific evidence the divers may be looking for, but one media report says there may be a computer hard drive in the lake. Mr. Bowditch said the search of the lake could take several days. New polls suggest Donald Trump remains the top pick of Republican voters less than 8 weeks before the first votes are cast in Iowa. Mr. Trump set off a political firestorm earlier in the week when he proposed temporarily banning Muslims from coming to the United States. Yet by Thursday, public opinion polls, both nationally and in key early voting states, showed Trump's popularity continuing to surge. With more from Houston, here's Greg Flakes for VOA.
Supporters of billionaire real estate magnate Donald Trump seem unbothered by his blunt and often offensive statements. Even when he says things that are proven to be wrong, they maintain their zeal. Kirby Goidell, who works on public policy research at Texas A&M University, says many people see Trump as refreshingly frank.
His persona is brash and speak your mind, and it's okay if you're wrong as long as you're saying things that need to be said.
Recent polls in Iowa and South Carolina show growing support for Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Still, Donald Trump remains in the lead in most polls, and he's even tying Cruz in his home state of Texas. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
Now, the Iowa caucuses are scheduled for less than 2 months from now, February 1st, 2016, and the first primary in the state of New Hampshire is just over a week after that on February 9th. Joe Palca in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, December 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Rwanda's Electoral Commission says it's ready to hold next week's constitutional referendum that would keep President Kagame in power.
When we talk about readiness in election management, we mean about registration of voters. We are talking about distribution of voters' cards. We are talking about acquisition of election materials. So we think we are ready.
Charles Munyaneza is Executive Secretary of Rwanda's Electoral Commission. The UN says the DRC government is engaged in clampdown on the opposition and media. Nigerian doctors call for taxes to improve healthcare affordability. And there's been another stumbling block to South Sudan rebels' advance team to Juba.
As of now, we are ready to receive you, but you come with your 30, no more. You want to bring in more, bring them thereafter. We said, discuss all the outstanding issues. Thereafter, we'll be ready to receive them.
Michael Makui, South Sudan's Minister of Information, low-income Nairobi residents turn to community currency. A human rights summit seeks greater U.S. leadership. And FIFA corruption scandal is masking abuse of workers in Qatar. Those stories, plus Mark Omar's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rwanda's Electoral Commission says it is ready to hold next week's national referendum that would allow President Paul Kagame to run for a third seven-year term in 2017. After that, he would also be eligible to run for two additional five-year terms. Mr. Kagame, 58, has ruled Rwanda since his army ended the 1994 genocide and ousted Hutu extremists from power. The referendum dates are December 17 for the diaspora and December 18 for Rwandans inside the country. Charles Munyaneza, Executive Secretary of the National Electoral Commission, says over 4 million Rwandan voters requested for the referendum and that the commission is only trying to fulfill its mandate to deliver a free and fair electoral process.
When we talk about readiness in election management, we mean about registration of voters. We are talking about distribution of voters' cards. We are talking about acquisition of election materials. We are talking about earmarking and setting up polling stations. We are talking about recruitment and the training of election staff, including election volunteers. And, of course, we are talking about sensitization and mobilization of voters to vote. So we think we are ready.
A member of the opposition in Rwanda has said that your commission did not properly educate the public or gave the people enough time to understand exactly what they are going to vote for.
We have not heard that from that member of opposition. He or she has never approached us, but as far as we are concerned, we've put in place everything possible to reach the population. We are putting in place a mechanism. We are using our structures from national headquarters to our villages. We are using the media. We are using our partners in the civil society. And we think the people of Rwanda are ready. After all, everybody knows that over 4 million Rwandan voters requested for this. And we think those 4 million Rwandan voters are set and are ready for the referendum. And we are privileged that we've got the advantage of using one language, and communication is very easy. So we think we should be ready for the referendum come 18th of this month.
As you said, Charles, over 4 million Rwandans gave the go-ahead for this referendum. Some people say if more than 4 million Rwandans have petitioned the parliament to amend the constitution, then why waste money to have a referendum?
We are talking of 4 million, but we have got 6.4 million registered voters in Rwanda. So we've got more than 2.4 million Rwandan voters who are registered and who officially did not petition. And even if all of them had petitioned, then we have got to the vote and decide. Because whatever was done was not done by the Electoral Commission, and the Electoral Commission is the one in charge of election management. So we have to take the vote to the population.
Can you describe for me what the ballot looks like?
It's one question. People will be deciding whether they approve the amendment of the Constitution, and then there will be places for people either to vote saying no or saying yes. So that's basically the structure. But internally here, we are having a very massive program in which we are educating the people on how to use the ballot paper.
does it bother your commission or, say, people in Rwanda, what some in the international community are saying, like the United States, to say that what is happening is not good, that you're trying to perpetuate someone in power when there can be another form of democracy where the people can choose?
Well, we haven't heard what the international community are saying. What we are doing is listening to what the people of Rwanda are saying. So we are just trying to make sure that they go to the vote knowing how they are going there and how they are going to cast their vote. We are trying as much as possible to make sure that we fulfill our mandate as an independent commission. And the people of Rwanda are looking up to us to make sure to deliver a free and fair electoral process leading to a process that they are able to cast their vote and decide their future.
Charles Munyaneza is Executive Secretary of Rwanda's National Electoral Commission. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kigali. The South Sudan government says an advance team of the rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar will not arrive in Juba today, Friday, as previously scheduled. As Philipton Alel of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba, the government and the rebels are still far apart on how many members should be part of the rebel advance team.
Juba wins only 30 officials on the advance team, while the SPLM-IO wins 609. IGAD mediators are proposing that 601 opposition officials be included on the advance team. South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makwe told reporters in Juba that an advance team is meant to prepare ground for the arrival of a larger number of opposition officials. He says 609 officials, as proposed by the opposition leaders, is not necessary.
As of now, we are ready to receive you, but you come with your 30, no more. You want to bring in more, bring them thereafter. We sat, discuss all the outstanding issues, and agree thereafter we'll be ready to receive them.
Makwe says an advance team will include opposition lead negotiator Taban Dengai to discuss the security of Juba and the transfer of opposition police and military to Juba. But he says in some areas, security is still unstable.
There are some states to which if these ones go there, they will get a rough nose, a bloody nose. This is very clear. There are some states that are still breathing fire, and the government is trying its level best to create the necessary conducive atmosphere so that when these people go, they will not be going alone, but they will be moving together with the government delegation.
Makwe says the government has communicated these security concerns to the opposition and IGAD mediators. He says the delay of the advance team in Juba to discuss containment of rival forces, formation of a constitutional amendment committee, and selection of ministries for a transitional government could delay full implementation of the peace deal.
Because the transitional government of national unity is associated with the adoption and signing into law of the amended constitution. It is associated with the incorporation of the agreement into the Constitution. So up to now, we are in a vacuum. We are in a vacuum because the pre-transitional period has ended and the transitional period has not started.
Makwe says the two parties are still negotiating on the advance team's number, but says he is confident the two parties will agree on a number and a new date for the arrival in Juba. For VOA News, I am Philipton Aleu in Juba.
An association of doctors in Nigeria says the government must do more to improve access and affordability of health care in Africa's most populous country. Christine reports with Ibrahima Yakubu in Kaduna, Nigeria.
Nigerian Medical Association President Kayode Obembe says Nigeria's doctors are overstretched. He estimates there is one doctor for every 6,000 patients in Nigeria, a ratio far and above World Health Organization recommendations. And many of Nigeria's medical school graduates go overseas, he says. Those that stay in the country tend to live in cities, not in the rural areas where they are also needed.
We still need to put more efforts so that we can get more doctors, and not just getting more doctors, to ensure that they are evenly distributed to take care of every part of the community.
Samuel Ulumakan is a doctor in the northern city of Kaduna who teaches at a local medical school. He says doctors in Nigeria are poorly paid and hospitals lack proper equipment. Many doctors decide they would rather work in another country.
Some of them don't like to work at home because even the country itself cannot meet up with their needs, salary and other things.
But even though some people want to be doctors, the high cost of education and training keeps many people from going to medical school, Olamakan says.
We are calling the federal government to help us to be given admission as much as possible so that the doctors, the numbers of doctors in Nigeria will be increased, and all these challenges we are facing will be reduced.
The end result is that people in rural areas who lack access to doctors often rely on family members or poorly trained pharmacists when they get sick, Olamakan said. At a meeting held last week, the Nigerian Medical Association called for the government to levy a tax on cigarettes, alcohol, and cell phone credits. Obembe says that money could pay for a national health insurance plan so poor people can afford preventative medical care. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Friday, December 11th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Brila FM, in Lagos, Nigeria. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. A new United Nations report says there has been a clampdown this year on opposition, media, and civil society in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The report documents 20 extrajudicial killings by state agents after demonstrations in January and more than 600 arbitrary arrests and detentions in connection with the electoral process between January and September. Nick Long reports from the capital, Kinshasa.
The DRC government has said it rejects the whole UN report, but its main author, UN Joint Human Rights Office in DRC Director Jose Maria Aranas, tells VOA the government published a higher figure for the number of people killed in the protests in January. The government has in the past thanked his office for information, he says.
Our information is shared with over 15 national authorities, for which we get letters back and correspondence from the authorities, either thanking us, sometimes rejecting the information.
The report notes an increase in threats against media workers as well as human rights defenders and the government's political opponents. As an example, it cites the intelligence service's arrest of news vendor Dido Zamangwana, who was selling a paper called C News. Mike Mukibayi is the editor of C News.
C'est juste le distributeur de journal. C'est lui qui prend le journal à l'imprimerie pour l'amener à la...
Zamangwana is just a news vendor, he says. He's the man who collects the paper from the printer and sells it in the street. And he's been held for 4 months, arbitrarily and without trial. Mukibayi was himself jailed for 11 months last year and released just 3 days after his news vendor was arrested. His office is barricaded by police, and he says it is a miracle he still manages to print some editions.
Ils m'ont envoyé deux émissaires qui sont venus chez moi.
Two people came to see me, says Mukibayi, to say that if I cooperated, not only would the news vendor be released, but also I could publish my paper. And they asked me how much money I wanted for a deal.
Je leur ai dit que j'étais un journaliste, que je n'avais pas à m'engager dans ce genre de négociations, que j'étais pas politique.
He says he told them he is a journalist and cannot negotiate like that. He's not a politician. He says he's running an investigative newspaper and he will carry on doing so in an independent way. Mukibayi's sentence was the longest imposed on any journalist here recently. C News has published frequent exclusive stories that no other Congolese paper dared print. In response to Mukibayi, Information Minister Lambert Mende told VOA that CNews does not exist in the repertoire at his ministry. Mukibayi will do anything just to harm this country's image, he added. Two journalists have been killed in the DRC this year and some 40 others detained because of their work, according to Journalists in Danger, a Congolese media rights organisation. Nick Long for VOA News, Kinshasa.
Leading human rights advocates gathered in Washington on the eve of Human Rights Day yesterday, Thursday, to address the role of the United States as a force for progress in its ability to expose and undermine human rights abuses at home and abroad. The summit sought to build consensus for political action on human rights issues. Ramon Taylor reports.
This year's Human Rights First Summit centered on the global refugee crisis, the spread of violent extremism, and the rise of authoritarianism. Challenges in which, the organization says, the U.S. must play a key role.
At Human Rights First, we believe that American leadership continues to be essential in the global struggle for human rights. That's why we press our government to live up to its ideals in its foreign policy and here at home.
Democratic Senator Ben Cardin, one of two U.S. congressmen in attendance, said the challenges in the fight for human rights are global, but not insurmountable.
Our ideals are universal values, and there's broad global support for these values. We will win this debate, and we will win by our actions. And I must tell you, I am optimistic.
Winning the fight, Cardin added, will mean a safer world for future generations. This year's summit was one of multiple events in Washington commemorating the United Nations-sponsored Human Rights Day, observed every year on December 10. It celebrates the UN General Assembly's 1948 adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Ramon Taylor, VOA News.
Several low-income settlements outside Kenya's capital, Nairobi, are using a new community-based currency. As Lenny Ruvaga reports for VOA from Nairobi, the pesos are equal in value to the Kenyan shilling and can be spent in the community just like cash.
Here in Kawangware, an informal settlement on the outskirts of Kenya's capital, students make their way to Sifa Primary School. They pay their tuition with Gatina pesos. The school is one of several institutions that accept the community currency. Teacher Josephine Ouma says the currency has made life easier.
This currency works in a way that it circulates. So as a teacher, I get it from the parent. And I still take the same currency back to the parents to buy their goods. So it's a circulation process that I don't think there can be any scarcity.
The NGO Grassroots Economics rolled out the currency here last year. The pesos are only valid here in Gatina Village, part of the settlement.
Community currency, as you know, is a legal tender that acts as a promissory note and works hand in hand with the national currency. So in the event a member has less of the national currency, they're free to supplement that with the community currency so as to get access to the goods and services they may need.
The NGO has given pesos to about 500 locals. Each member must be vouched for by four business owners. The members then receive a maximum of 400 pesos, of which 200 are saved and pooled for community improvement projects. The rest, they can spend like cash. But those 500 members are a fraction of the approximately 10,000 people living in Gatina Village.
There are some challenges with the currency, since there are a lot of people here who have not accepted its use. But I believe that once we educate them on it, they will accept it, since many more are joining as we continue to enlighten.
The NGO says it started with a small number of members to make monitoring easier. But experts note that community currencies do have limitations.
It prevents you from getting goods and services from outside the economy, the local economy, and that means that the exchange networks are often quite small. A second weakness is the organization. At the moment, a lot of community currencies are organized in a voluntary form, and often after a certain amount of time, the impetus runs out.
Grassroots Economics plans to expand the initiative to communities in Rwanda, Uganda, and Tanzania in 2016. Participants in Kenya say the currency provides a cushion against hard times. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Amnesty International says the corruption crisis in football's world governing body, FIFA, is drawing attention away from abuses of migrant workers who are helping to construct venues for the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Henry Richwell reports.
Amnesty says in recent months, Qatar has made some progress in improving the rights of migrant workers. Under the so-called new wage protection system, big companies must now regularly pay their employees by electronic bank transfer, helping to address problems over late or missing wages. But Amnesty's Mustafa Kadri says there are still holes in the legislation.
Workers that are most exposed to abuse in Qatar are those employed in the smallest companies. And they might have a three-month visa, they may be informally employed. They're very hard to track these small companies. This law does not seem to effectively apply to that pool of workers.
There are around 1.5 million migrant workers in Qatar. Most are employed under the kafala sponsorship system, where the employer is responsible for their legal status. Amnesty says this led to major abuses, including the confiscation of employees' passports.
An employer has the power to control where a worker goes, when they leave the country, whether they can change jobs. And the fact that that creates an incredible power imbalance.
Kadri accuses FIFA, football's world governing body, and the organiser of the World Cup of abdicating its responsibilities.
We do have a concern that the focus on the corruption allegations and FIFA's leadership is diverting attention away from human rights and FIFA's responsibility with respect to human rights.
Qatar has strongly denied claims that its officials paid FIFA delegates to win their votes to host the 2022 World Cup, and FIFA's ethics committee ruled in November that any breaches of the rules were only of very limited scope. Swiss police are investigating corruption claims against suspended FIFA head Sepp Blatter, while scores of FIFA officials have been indicted in an ongoing US investigation. Speaking in London Thursday, US Attorney General Loretta Lynch urged wholesale reform.
It's incumbent upon every country that participates in this great sport to be involved in FIFA's reform.
José Luis Meisner, the former General Secretary of South American Soccer's governing body, appeared this week before an Argentine judge who will decide on an extradition request from the United States. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Here's Mark Ome in Johannesburg, South Africa, with the rest of Daybreak Africa Sports. Good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with athletics. Julius Yego and Vivian Cheruiyot were crowned the 2015 Kenya Male and Female Athlete of the Year in Nairobi, Kenya on Thursday night. Yego, the world javelin champion, is the first Kenyan to win a gold medal in a field event on the global stage. Cheruiyot earned accolade after winning the 10,000 meters at the World Championship. Four-time world 3,000 meters steeplechase champion Ezekiel Kemboi received the men's long distance award, while three-time world 1,500 meter champion Asbel Kiprop received the middle distance award. World 400-meter hurdles champion Nicholas Bett bagged the Outstanding Performance Award. Eliud Kipchoge, victor at the London and Berlin Marathons, scooped the Men's Road Running Award, while Gladys Cherono, the Berlin Marathon winner, bagged the Women's Road Running Award. Kumari Turkey, the 1,500-meter gold medalist at the World Youth Championship, Africa Youth Championship, and Commonwealth Youth Games, earned the Young Male Athlete of the Year Award, while World Youth 2,000-meter steeplechase champion Selfyn Chespol was named the Young Female Athlete of the Year. Meanwhile, seven countries have submitted bids to stage the World Race Walking Team Championship and the World Junior Athletics Championships due next year, the IAAF revealed in Monaco. Ecuador, Italy, Mexico and Ukraine are vying to stage the race walking event, while Australia, India and Poland have their sights trained on the Junior Athletics Championship. The bidding process became necessary after Russia, the original host for the two events, was suspended from World Athletics. Turning to football, the curtains come down at the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations when Algeria and Nigeria clash in the finals in Dakar, Senegal, tomorrow Saturday. Prior to the finals, Senegal faced South Africa in the bronze medal playoff. In Japan, the Democratic Republic of Congo's Orange Africa Champions League title holders TP Mazembe tackled Japan's Sanferese Hiroshima in the quarterfinals at the FIFA Club World Cup in Osaka on Sunday. Sanferese Hiroshima earned the right to challenge TP Mazembe following their 2-0 victory over New Zealand's Auckland City in Yokohama on Thursday. In rugby, Kenya play England as South Africa face Zimbabwe at the start of the second leg of the IRB 7 series in Cape Town, South Africa tomorrow Saturday. All four teams are drawn in the same group for their preliminary round fixtures. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. One of the top fugitive suspects in the 1994 Rwandan genocide has been arrested in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The United Nations says that Ladislas Untagenzwa, a former mayor accused of orchestrating the death of some 20,000 ethnic Tutsis in Nyakizu, Kamiu, was arrested in Congo on Wednesday. That's it for this Friday, December 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Marco Ouman, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you a very good weekend.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in
feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.